You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. And instead of new year, new sodes, I want to take this January to celebrate the best of last year. You heard? Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party. So you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. You know what? Socks. Not wearing compression socks. Yeah, absolutely. I used to think compression socks were those knee-high stockings my grandma wore with her flat tan Velcro strap sneakers. But that was before I learned about Comrade's incredibly fun-looking compression socks. Not to judge them too hard, but the peeps at Comrade legit spent 2 years developing these adorable, non-ugly, knee-high socks that provide all-day comfort and deliver certified health benefits. I'm sure you've heard that wearing compression socks on airplanes helps keep your blood circulating to combat jet lag, fatigue, and even reduce serious health risks like blood clots. But did you know that wearing compression socks makes walking Tommy or your pup, cooking in the kitchen, hopefully recipes from partyinmyplants.com or from my upcoming book, Party in Your Plants, out in April 2020, or sitting doing endless emails, all much more comfortable experiences? Comrade socks are proven by myself also, as well as studies, to energize our legs, reduce swelling, and increase circulation, all things that truly have been lessening the frequency that I have to go get cheap foot massages for my incredibly consistently sore feet. Do I feel kind of dorky promoting compression socks? Yes. Do I swear that you can trust me that these socks are worth me feeling dorky right now? Also, yes. And do I have a special offer for how you can get Comrade's rad compression socks for 20% less than non-Party in My Plants podcast listening humans? Hell yes. Go to comradesocks.com/party to see how fun their socks really are, and then to try ordering one pair or a little bundle for 20% off. That's comradesocks.com, comradesocks.com/party, and use discount code PARTY at checkout. And then have a party in your incredibly comfortable and nourished feet. Today's episode is a rebroadcast of the Party in My Plants podcast top episode of 2019, which just so happened to come out as the first episode of 2019. This is like a colonic of a chat, a colonic for your stress and worries and anxiety, or at least in the way you view them. This chat will help you flush those old patterns right out of you. I cannot get enough of this guest, Sarah Knight's hilariously no BS, tough love, and her out-of-the-box mind-altering metaphors galores. And I'm not alone in my Sarah Knight obsession, no, considering that she's like an internationally best-selling author of 4, now going on 5 books. Her newest one just came out today. It's called Fuck No, How to Stop Saying Yes When You Can't, You Shouldn't, or You Just Don't Want To. And I am so honored to have Sarah's endorsement on my upcoming book. So in case you missed my first chat with Sarah back in episode number 70, you should know that this funny lady and super likable human is most well known for her first book called The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck, which has had readers from around the world laughing while taking away magical lessons in saying bye to unwanted obligations. Needless to say, this chat has a lot of unbleeped bleeps in it, so headphones are smart, and also because you'll want to focus on Sarah's unbelievably awesome advice on how to stop overthinking, how to go easy on your freakouts, how to stop stressing about the uncontrollable, and how to just let it all go. Sarah, you're back both in the bookstore and on the Party in My Plants podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I can't believe it's been like a year already, huh?
It has been a year, and you've written one book in that year. I mean, the first time you wrote like 3 books in like how many years?
Yes, just the one.
How does that feel? Is that easier?
You know, it's easier in some ways and it's more difficult in others. I'll put it that way.
Interesting. Well, last time we spoke at length about not giving more fucks than we need to. And today we're talking about calming the fuck down.
Indeed we are. And I'm still allowed to say those words on your podcast, right?
Clearly, because I just said them both. And clearly you have an affinity for the F word. Has that always been the case?
You know, I don't think I've ever not had an affinity for it, but I definitely started using it a lot more when I started writing these books. So.
It's so funny. It's your go-to thing. You're the F woman. So your fourth and newest book is called Calm the Fuck Down, and it's about taking all the bumps on the road of life in stride, no matter how big, small, absurd, or deeply real said bumps are. What was the impetus for you writing this book, Calm the Fuck Down?
You know, this was the first of my four books that really grew out of something that I felt like I really needed to do to improve my life. The life-changing magic of not giving a fuck was sort of a surprise. Like, you know, I've told that story of how I quit my job and moved to an island and, you know, started giving fewer fucks, and it all just kind of happened to me. Whereas calming the fuck down was something I needed to actively do. And I knew I needed to actively do it. And so, you know, part of that was the result of the move. And I write about that in the book. But part of it was also these very concerted efforts to just change my mindset and react to problems in a different way.
From just a writer's standpoint, how was that different for you? Like, this book, based on what you're saying, is clearly more of like a heart book based on your own personal journey versus the other ones, maybe not as much. How was that different in the writing process?
This one was a little bit more of a struggle in the writing just because it's a more serious topic. The other books, I feel like, are very proactive, you know, go out, get what you want, set goals, be yourself. And this book is very reactive. It's, hey, bad shit's going to happen to you. You know, bad shit happens to good people. So how are you going to calm the fuck down and deal with it? And so it meant that in order to retain the sort of funny and entertaining, voice that I'm known for, I really needed to dig a little bit deeper because I'm writing about what winds up being some pretty serious topics.
Yeah. I mean, as I was reading it, I was like, damn, like, this must have been so challenging to write because you are telling people, like, shit's going to happen. Life can suck. Good, like you said, good things can happen to, no, bad things can happen to good people. Uh-huh. And I mean, that's really tough to maintain humor through that kind of narrative.
It is, and we will find out whether I succeeded.
I bet you have. In my mind, you have. And I really like how in the beginning you preface that there are like two types of anxiety, right? You talk about how there's like the diagnosable mental illness, and then there's like just the anxiety that like...
Situational anxiety is what I call it. Yeah. And that's really important because I suffer from clinical anxiety and panic disorder, but I also don't have it nearly as hard and as difficult as some other people I know. So I want to make sure that people who have it worse than me aren't reading this book and thinking, wow, she's being really cavalier. You know, that's not going to help me because I'm like seriously mentally ill. But I also want people who are like, I don't have anxiety, but yeah, you know what? That job interview makes me really nervous, to understand that you can call it anxiety, you can call it stress, you can call it nerves, you can call it worries. But at the end of the day, the ways that you can counteract all of that stuff are pretty much one and the same on a sliding scale of seriousness. Like, obviously, I'm not prescribing medication to anybody. Right. I'm not a doctor, as I say a million times in the book.
There you go.
But a lot of these techniques are useful for people that are all along the spectrum of anxiety suffering.
Yeah, spectrum. That's a good word for it. Is there a particular story, maybe like a mid-grocery store meltdown, that inspired you to write this book? Or was it just like the logical next topic to cover? I mean, the first three were tremendously awesome. The life-changing magic, not giving a fuck, you do you. And what's the third one?
Get your shit together.
Get your shit together. And I know those were all, they're all so useful, but like you said, this is born from your own experience. So was there an actual, like, real, tangible experience that you were like, this is the next book?
I think the moments that you're sort of alluding to, the panic attacks in public, those were really what started me down the whole path of writing my first book and changing my life and getting to a calmer place. Calm the Fuck Down was really inspired by me just becoming okay with the idea of being a less type A, less easily freaked out, less rigid, restrictive person than I used to be. And I got a real shot in the arm when I moved from New York City to this tiny fishing village on the coast of the Dominican Republic, because things just don't go according to plan here. You just don't know if the thing that you're trying to get done is going to get done, and it probably isn't. And sometimes it's because of rain, and sometimes it's because of power outages, and sometimes it's just because people want to be on the beach and they just didn't show up for an appointment. So that paradigm shift that I personally went through, I realized after a few months here in the DR that I had to stop being so freaked out about things like that, or I would just, you know, just be constantly in a sort of semi state of panic about stuff. So as I was figuring out for myself how to stop worrying about things like that, that's when I was able to kind of back it out and make a process and be like, okay, when I'm feeling this way, here's what I should do. So if other people are feeling this way, here's what they can do. And it doesn't really matter where you live or what your life is like. All the stuff is pretty universally applicable.
Well, how ironic that you move from crazy New York City to the Dominican Republic and you're like, wow, I really got to do some mental work here. Like it's, I guess, and then you talk about in the book that like you've determined that one doesn't really need to uproot to an island in the middle of the Atlantic to calm the fuck down. And you say that anyone can do it if they shift their mindset. And I'd love for you to tell me more about that. I mean, when you realize, oh, wait, like my life in the DR ain't just life's a beach type of life. Like, that's crazy. I mean, that's what everybody expects. Like, you just are living peacefully over there. So what was that like? And how do you think, like, you know, myself and my husband who are like, God, should we move out of New York to have a calmer life? Like, maybe we don't need to. Like, how can we be calmer here with a mindset shift?
Exactly. So, you know, I've had friends and worked with people who go through addiction recovery, and they call this a geographical. And they're like, a geographical is not going to fix your problem. You thinking, oh, my life is going to be so much better if I just, you know, move or get out of my apartment, you know, move states or whatever, isn't the thing that works. So for me, like, I did this geographical. I moved to these white sand beaches and palm trees. And, you know, yes, in some sense, life is calmer and easier here. But what it really was about was me and how I react to outside stressors. And so what I learned is that it's a difference between things you can control and things you can't. And really the bulk of Calm the Fuck Down is about explaining how and why you can stop and should stop worrying about things you can't control. And it all goes back to my sort of general idea of mental decluttering that I talk about in all of the books. And this idea of, you know, discarding and organizing, discarding the worries about stuff you can't control and organizing your responses to the rest. And so for me, when I moved to the Dominican Republic, the things I couldn't control, you know, in New York, it was getting stuck on a subway and being late for a morning meeting and freaking out, even though there was nothing I could do about it.
Yeah.
And here it's, oh, the skies just opened up, so we're not going to be able to walk over to that, you know, dinner that we're supposed to meet people at in half an hour because we're going to get soaked. Oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it. We're just going to wait for the rain to pass. And the difference between the feeling that I felt when I was in those uncontrollable situations before I learned how to shift my mindset and the feeling now is, I mean, honestly, it's almost like taking a Xanax on a plane is for me, because I still have the thoughts. I'm like, oh, well, this is happening. I don't like it. Like, what if the plane falls out of the sky? But the Xanax keeps me from like the heart pounding kind of obsession, and the mindset shift can do the same thing. I mean, again, no substitute for medical intervention if you need it, but
are we going to make medical disclaimers this entire episode?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm very careful.
No, I'm just joking. No, totally. Wow. That's so fascinating. So you're telling me that like when you take a Xanax on a plane to help calm your nerves, you have noticed, because I've never taken a Xanax, so I don't really know, but you've noticed that when you consciously, you know, apply your mental decluttering, and we'll talk about your no worries method and all that, it's the same kind of vibe where like you're able to witness the worries and the fear, but like you're just detached from them.
That is exactly what I'm saying. And, you know, it's not, again, it's not a substitute for being in the middle of a panic attack, and probably a good shot of a benzodiazepine is what you need. But for me, being able to recreate that mindset without medication has made 80% of my panicky, anxious life, you know, improved. And so, and then when it gets a little bit too far, you know, then you call in the big guns.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and I talk about it in the book as, the analogy I make is creating your emotional puppies. So like puppies are great, right?
But yeah.
They, you can't get anything done when a puppy is running around. Like it's either too cute or it's jumping on you
or
it's
peeing everywhere,
something or whatever it is. Like it could be a good distraction or a bad distraction, but it is a distraction. And so I think that you sort of have to take, you know, the observation of whatever's going on that's upsetting you, then the emotion that you're feeling about it, whether that's panic or anger or sadness, and allow it to run its course, just like you would let a puppy run itself out until it was tired, and then put it in a box and set it in the corner so that you can be productive and do whatever it is that you need to do to get through the situation that you're in. And I also, the disclaimer is like, please don't email me about not crating your dog. It's a metaphor. It's not it's not me like advocating for dogs to be locked up. Like, please don't send me like emails about that.
Do you get emails like that sort of thing? Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah, it sounds like you get emails like that.
Yeah, when it's a hazard of writing humorous books is that the jokes don't always land. So
yeah, it's like text messages. Sometimes you get a text that someone's trying to make a joke, but you don't know, or vice versa, and then there's trouble. So that must be challenging for you. That must be something you worry about.
It's, yeah. Occupational hazard.
Yes. Well, the thing about your book is like what's so rad about it is that you really boil it down, at least in my mind, I'm sure this is your intention, but like the cause of anxiety really is worrying. And like you say, it's, you have to, where do I have it in my notes? The serenity prayer. What's so funny is you say, like, you guys know the serenity prayer, which is grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. And you say your book is just a blasphemous long form version of that prayer.
Yes, that sort of became clear to me when I was writing the book. And I was like, first, you have to accept the things you can't control. And then you have to dismiss. Like, where have I heard that before? Oh, right. Okay. So we're going to throw a bunch of curse words and some flowcharts and graphics in there. And, you know, but it's all the same idea. I think all of these self-help tropes and certainly the stuff I write about is stuff that's been around in different formats in different ways. And it's just a matter of reaching the audience that wants to hear it in the particular way that you want to say it. So
yeah,
my way is full of F-bombs as opposed to actual
jokes.
Praying. And
no, it's awesome.
And
but it's really fascinating because it is true. It's like your method. Well, let's go into your no worries method. I mean, step one is basically asking yourself if you can change it, right?
Right. If you can control it.
Control
and,
it.
You know, if you can, whether or not you can change the outcome or you could just control being prepared for the eventual outcome. So there's sort of a couple scales that I talk about, and one is probability. And that's really, if you're worried about something that hasn't happened yet, looking at it on a scale like a hurricane, 1 through 5, one is highly unlikely and 5 is inevitable. And anything that's a 1, 2, and even most 3s, you really shouldn't be worrying about right now because they're so unlikely that you're wasting time and energy and maybe money. What I call your freak out funds, which are basically the fuck bucks from the first, freaking out when you don't need to be doing that yet. And if it's a 5, if it's inevitable, then if it's definitely going to happen, you know, you probably don't even need to be worrying about it in the sense that like you're going to have to when it happens, but you could be preparing for it. So you could be taking that time and energy and money and putting it to good use, you know, so that you are much like in advance of a hurricane, you're boarding up the windows and you're securing the lawn furniture and whatever you're doing to make the impact less bad.
But let me ask you this, as you're saying that, I mean, a lot of what I find my husband and I worrying about is like family dynamics, which is kind of strange, I guess, but we always worry about like how a trip will be or how this family dinner will be or like if everyone's going to be on their best behavior or if it's like something to worry about. And like how, I don't know. Like, how do you prepare without worrying? Or how do you like worry and then allow, like, and prepare? Like, I don't know how to ask my question.
I hear you.
Okay, thanks.
So this is something I've actually gotten pretty good at. So
good.
I have, you know, I have my family, I have my husband's family. He's got step family. There's a lot of family that has to be taken into consideration at any given time. And we've gone on big family trips that have been, I would say, unmitigated disasters. And I don't think that if my in-laws heard me say that, they would disagree. And in the more recent past, I have been able to just be like, oh, like I am going to accept that everybody in this group is going to behave the way they always have. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to accept them for who they are. And I'm just not going to let myself get riled up about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to engage and respond. It's sort of like, you know, on Facebook when you see something and you just like want to jump in on the comments and then mm-hmm. you're like, oh no, then 8 other people are going to argue with me and then I'm going to have to be looking at this all day. Exactly. You know, so I've really kind of just said to myself, like, you can't control other people's behavior. You can only control your own response. And the less fuel you put on the fire, the less, you know, damaging the fire will be. So that has really worked for me. And some of the stuff that I talk about in the book is what I call sleight of mind. And
it's yes, really Houdini. Just like,
you know, a funny way to talk about changing your mindset.
I freaking love it.
Tricking yourself into thinking about something else, worrying about something else, preoccupying your brain with something else. And there are a lot of different ways to do that depending on your, you know, what you prefer and sort of what your life is. But I do think that it's a matter of just saying, like, I'm not going to engage in this. I'm not going to worry about this. It's going to be whatever it will be. And then I will handle it in a way that minimizes the stress for myself.
Do you think there's ever a good kind of worrying? Or do you think just across the board, it's a bad thing and it's what causes anxiety and we all need to calm the fuck down?
Well, I do think there's something that I call productive, helpful, effective worrying, the acronym for which is FEW, which will not translate into all of the foreign editions of my book, but
oh, yeah, no.
We get it. So, and that is really my way of saying, look, I get it. We can't necessarily just completely stop worrying about things. We're just not wired that way. But if you are going to spend that time, energy, and money, if you're going to withdraw those freak out funds, spend them on something productive and helpful and effective that is going to, you know, impact the outcome of the thing you're worried about, that is going to make your life better, that is going to help you survive whatever it is that's coming down the pike. You know, take those freak out funds. If you're not able to conserve them, which is what half of the book is about, then convert them into something productive, helpful, and effective. So, you know, I think it's sort of like if you're going on a family trip, and you know that, you know, too much together time is eventually going to cause an explosion. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of thinking about it and having, you know, arguments, imaginary arguments in your head and whatever, take some time, energy, and money and book yourself, you know, a 2-hour massage in the middle of one of the afternoons so that you know that right mm-hmm. after lunch, you'll say bye, everyone, and you'll have a chance to, you know, regroup and kind of get back into your own headspace before you have to deal with them again. And this kind of stuff doesn't have to be expensive. Like that you can just say, like, I'm going on a walk.
Yeah, I was just going to say, go for a run. Yeah.
You know, and just know that you are preemptively, productively, helpfully, and effectively taking yourself out of the situation that's causing you worry.
That's cool. Okay, I get that now. We came full circle with the hurricane boarding up the windows. That makes a lot of sense. So that's great for like future tripping, I guess, or, you know, like worrying mm-hmm. about things in the future. But what about worrying about, like, one of my biggest worries is my inbox. Like, I am just perpetually stressed about all the email. Like, you know, you do, I'm sure you do it, but you open emails like while you're walking down the street or the beach or whatever. Right. Like, you open them and then you don't want to respond right then, but then they're like on you, you know, they're on your back, they're in your mind. And I'm just feel like I'm always worried and stressed and brought down by like all these emails on top of me. What strategy of the million awesome ones in your book applies to that kind of worrying?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry that you were constantly stressed out by your email. We need to fix that. One of the tips in the book is called limit your exposure. And this tip is actually in reference to sort of like the world falling apart and like how to calm the fuck down when the world is on fire, which yep. I feel like it is right now and was the entire time I was writing the book.
Yes.
But it works for things like email too. Anything that brings you a constant amount of stress, limit your exposure. Don't open your emails when you're walking down the street or the beach. Don't open your emails after you have climbed into bed at night. You know, promise yourself that you won't look at emails when you're on public transportation. Whatever you mm-hmm. can do to reduce your exposure to that stressor, that is what you can control. You can't control the email that comes into your box. You can't control the problem that is being introduced to you by whoever sent you that email. You can control not looking at it until you're in a place where you know you'll be able to deal with it. And, you know, I have to take my own advice a lot. There are times where I get you know, things get out of control and I open an email that I know I shouldn't. I've had 3 glasses of wine and I'm like, God damn it. I knew this was going to make me angry and I can't respond to it right now. You know, whatever it is, like, it doesn't have to be anger. It could also be like, oh no, that's really upsetting. What am I going to do to fix that mistake? So I have learned now that I just don't open my emails when I know that I'm not in a place to deal with them.
That's really helpful. Thank you for your empathy. And that's actually, I mean, I know that. I've thought about taking off the email app from my phone, but then I'm like, what? Am I going to put myself in the ice age here? Like, I can't just do that. That's irresponsible, but maybe I should do that.
You know, I have to tell you, I've been kind of working on out this little theory as I've been doing interviews like this one. And I don't know how old you are, but I just turned 40. And so I am part of the very last generation that grew up without email, certainly without constant access to it. My parents may have gotten a modem when I was a senior in high school. I didn't have email until I went to college. Mm-hmm. So I actually remember that human beings did their jobs and went about their lives and everything was fine before we were constantly attached to the hip by email.
Yeah.
So there's something in me that I've like been really forcing myself to access that knowledge that like the world is not going to end if I don't respond to emails for 11 hours. And that while, you know, instant communication and global information, you know, minute by minute updates for news and entertainment and all of that is great in its way, it also has really, really toxic effects on me personally. And mm-hmm. so I just have to be like, you know what? I survived without email for 21 years. Like, I can do it for a day.
Yeah. I think about that with social media all the time. So I'm about to be 30. And I mean, I remember a time when we didn't have Facebook and Instagram checking in on what everybody was eating and wearing and doing every second of every day. I remember we just lived our lives and maybe mm-hmm. would like post photos to like web page, web pics. I don't know, some of these weird things later, like a
MySpace
month. Yeah. Like after the event to be like, hey, this happened. It was fun. But mm-hmm. like I miss those times so much. And so I do the same thing with giving myself sort of like rational permission to not use social media for a little mm-hmm. bit because like we once survived without that too.
Yep.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on how social media contributes to anxiety? I mean, do you have any tips or systems in your book about how we can have less FOMO or any ways to make our Instagram feeds less anxiety inducing?
Well, it's a really big, broad topic, but sort of at the face of it, like I said, I think it's a little bit toxic. It certainly is for me. I just get overwhelmed mostly with bad news. Like mostly it's political stuff and mm-hmm. climate change and, you know, immigrants being detained at the border and things that just make me like so sad and angry and upset. I don't have a real problem with like looking at Instagram and wishing that I was as thin, happy, pretty, rich, whatever as other people. That's not where my FOMO is. My issue is more like getting depressed by the world. But okay, thing that I think people really need to remember about Instagram and Twitter, you choose who and what you follow. And so if you find that you are feeling a little injection of, you know, of self-pity or feeling like, or, you know, negative about your life or your body or your work with as a mom or whatever it is, because you're looking at somebody's amazing Instagram feed, seek out Instagram feeds that reflect the life that would make you happy and that you feel comfortable with. You know, I've really mm-hmm. been looking, really actively at body positive Instagram feeds lately because I don't know. I just think it's important to like get a mirror reflected of like what real life is instead of just like models and wellness blogs that are really tip top perfect all the time. And it's really like I've noticed a difference in my attitude. So I would say, you know, if you can't avoid it, particularly if you're like you and me, where that's really part of your life, social media is part of your mm-hmm. business, remember that you choose what you look at. And if a particular account is making you feel bad because it's making you feel, you know, the FOMO or it's making you feel less than good enough, then don't follow it, you know, and seek out other things that are real and feel like, you know, feel like you and keep injecting those into your daily life as well.
What's awesome about all this advice you're giving is it's all about giving permission for people to do the things they can control, like control the things you mm-hmm. can control. It's like really just so straightforward in that sense. And I know that one of the first questions you say to ask ourselves when we worry is, can I control it?
Yes, that is what I call the one question to rule them all. Is that?
So
is that
when
a dog?
That's my dog. That is my dog. Like, yep. There he goes. Should I put him in the crate?
You do whatever works for you and your relationship with your dog. I was like, is my husband coughing? I call it the one question to rule them all. And, you know, when I first finished the manuscript of the book and I gave it to my editors, I have editors in the UK, in the US, my agent, my husband, a couple people, you know, from my publishing company were the first ones to read it. And they all responded and they were like, why didn't I think of that? The one question to rule them all. Of course, can I control it? It's so simple. And I was like, yeah, I mean, it just really, it's common sense, but sometimes you need somebody to point it out to you.
So what I'm getting at is like, if the first question or the only question to rule all is when we're worried, can I control it? Would you back it up and say that all of our anxiety really stems from worry? So then asking ourselves, can I control it, will help alleviate anxiety?
I would say that a lot of what we think of as anxiety comes from those worries about things we can't control. There's definitely an aspect to anxiety, the mental illness, that probably cannot be ameliorated with, you know, intellect and kind of logic and reasoning. You know, so I want to be careful about saying, oh, you can just sort of think your way out of it. But I do think that when I sat down and assessed my life and my history and my anxiety and panic and all of that, it became clear to me that things that were causing so much stress in my life were things that I couldn't control and I needed to let them go. And I give that example of being on the subway. The subway has stopped for 40 minutes, you know, in a tunnel. You're going to be late for work. You can't tell anybody. You don't have reception. There is nothing you can do. And I used to get really panicked by that. And now I'm just like, you know, I was on my way to film Good Morning America last year for my book. And like, there was just a ton of traffic and there was not anything that was going to get me there any faster. And I was going to be 15 minutes late. I didn't set up the car. You know, I would have given more time, but they set up the car to come at that particular time. And I was like, well, I'm not going to start sweating and, you know, and hyperventilating about this. I'm just going to let it go and it will be what it is.
Wow. I'm literally sweating and hyperventilating right now. My dog won't stop. And I'm just, should I just let it go or should I like beat him up?
You should let it go.
All right. All right, guys. That we're going to have a little background noise of Tommy because that's so interesting. I mean, that's what I was just thinking is like, I'm worried about this barking. And I'm like, well, I guess I should just let it go. And
it's just life.
You know, it is. This episode is enthusiastically sponsored by a product that couldn't possibly float my boat more, Four Sigmatic. My boat is so floated by Four Sigmatic's mushroom drinks that any more floating would turn my boat into an airplane because it's flying. Okay, so the first time I tried a packet of Four Sigmatic mushroom tea and a glass of hot water, I was muy skeptical because of this whole mushroom thing being really trendy right now, and I'm always reluctant to hop on trend trains. Wow, we're really covering all the modes of transportation here. But I drank those shrooms, and I felt truly awesome. It's hard to explain. I just felt way more awesome than I felt before I drank it. Since then, I consistently consume at least one type of shrooms a day, and it helps me know it's going to be a bright, 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 sunshiny day, even when it's rainy and gray, because I am telling you these mushrooms are magic. Although they don't make me hallucinate in a bathtub like my ex-boyfriend's famous magic mushroom experience, which in hindsight, he seemed way too proud of. But nobody's hallucinating the magical effects of these shrooms, okay? They are ultra scientifically proven to boost immunity and gut health. Yes, please, and thank you. And the four different shrooms that Four Sigmatic uses most, hence the four in Four Sigmatic, wink, wink, they all do different epic things for your bod. Reishi helps you relax. Cordyceps give you a non-caffeinated energy for sports and stuff. Lion's mane, which does not come from a lion's mane, boosts your brain. And chaga is a mega charge for your immune system. I weave all four of those separate mushrooms into my life by way of the teas. That's what I'm talking about here, people, are mushroom teas that you dissolve in a packet of hot water and hiya. But I also fancy myself some of their fancier shroom concoctions. They have this relaxing, thanks to the Reishi hot cocoa that I pretty much make every night with almond milk. They have matcha powder, which is the only matcha I now use. They have these magic mushroom chai latte packets that you can add to water or almond milk for a hot or iced, sweetest sippable treat. And I have to say, even though I don't drink coffee, Four Sigmatic is kind of famous for their multiple kinds of organic, much better for you coffee, even mocha mixes. So you can mocha chocolate. Yeah. Okay, enough from me. I'm sorry. I just finished a mushroom matcha latte and I'm flying high. But because you listen to this podcast, thanks so much for doing that, by the way. You can save 15% off any and all Four Sigmatic shroomy stuff you'll want to buy off of their site, foursigmatic.com, using code PARTYINMYPLANTS. Or you can just go to foursigmatic, foursigmatic.com/PARTYINMYPLANTS to automatically save that 15%, baby. Oh, by the way, did I mention that I don't even really like eating mushrooms? Yeah, but now, thanks to Four Sigmatic, my body doesn't need to have shroom FOMO. Okay, again, hit up foursigmatic.com/partyinmyplants to save 15% on this mega boat floating stuff that I always find stuffed into my pockets, purses, luggage, or my bra because I just can't get enough. So I love the part in your book about shit people in my Twitter feed are worried about. What stemmed that?
Well, you know, every book that I've written, I've done like a questionnaire, an online, you know, anonymous survey just to get, just to get some material, you know, take people's temperatures on things that are important to them and that aren't important to them. And this time around, I just went out on Twitter and I said, hey, you know, I'm working on this chapter. Like, what kind of shit are you worried about right now? Like, what kind of shit is happening to you? And I got like an amazing array of responses from really stuff that, you know, you or I might think, well, that doesn't seem very important or upsetting at all. And then to stuff like really heavy, heavy shit. So I thought, you know what? Like, I'm going to see if I can apply what I call my no worries method, which is discard the things you can't control, organize the stuff that you can to all of this stuff and see if I can, you know, if I can make it work, because obviously the method should work relatively universally on everything. So, and I think it did. So
it's so scientific the way your mind thinks.
It's just the way I understand how to make sense of life, and the way that I can bring order to my stress is through logic and reasoning. And, you know, one of the things I say toward the end of the book is, you know, I'm not here to teach you how to access your feelings. Like, this is not the, you know, everybody's going to feel better almanac or whatever. This is blunt, emotionless, pragmatic advice. And maybe it's not the advice you're getting from your friends and family because they're too busy telling you everything's going to be okay. Don't worry. It's okay. It's not so bad. And I'm like, you know what? It is bad.
Yes. Thank you. That's my favorite thing to do when somebody says they're struggling with something is be like, yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
And it's kind of not PC. Like last night, my husband was saying something about work that he's like really upset about. I'm like, yeah, that blows. Like, I'm like, that would suck so much. And he's like, whoa. And I'm like, I'm just empathizing because that's what I'd want to hear when I'm upset. I hate when I say something that I'm upset about and someone's like, oh, don't worry. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. For me, it's like, okay, like, feel that feeling and then fucking deal with it. Like, the only thing that's going to fix this is you dealing with it. So, and again, that's not for everybody, but I think for my audience, the people that are gravitating toward the no fucks given guides and who I think will get a lot out of calm the fuck down are the people who respond well to that little bit of like a kick in the ass.
Yeah.
You know, no,
it's kind of a big kick. I would say it's a big kick.
Well, it's a big kick, but I'm not trying to be nice here. I'm just trying to be realistic.
Honest. Yeah. It's funny. I'm writing a book right now myself, and I thought I was going to put all these flow charts and quizzes and stuff in it like you, because you do such a great job. I can't do it. My brain does not work that way at all. You have something special and unique going on up there that you can even create one of your million flow charts and things, because it not easy.
It's not easy. It's not easy for me either, but it usually takes a few tries before I'm like, wait, that doesn't match up. No, you need to know this first and then that. No. Okay. And then somebody at my publisher like makes it look neat and tidy for me, because my original flowchart drafts look like a serial killer. Like, it's really, it's crazy. It's not.
Well, it's very impressive. I tried for a second. I was like, nope, not going to happen. I can't even do this. So that's pretty
cool. We all have different strengths.
Yes. Well, when you were applying your no worries method to the shit people in your Twitter feed were worried about, what was like the most surprising thing someone was worried about that you were able to diffuse with your no worries method?
Oh God, I wish I could remember all of them. But, you know, somebody was like, what if I get bitten by a raccoon? And I was like, don't hang out with raccoons. Like, that's an easy one, you know? And then
that was
somebody
something
else
someone was,
like, was
worried about.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then one of them was like, what if I wait too long? Like, I'm happy and I'm in a good relationship, but what if my partner wait too long to get married and have kids? And I was like, well, okay, you're happy and you're in a good relationship. And I have no judgments about whether somebody has kids in or out of wedlock. But your question is, what if we wait too long to get married and then have kids? And I'm like, you know how biology works. You understand that if you want to have kids on a, you know, in an easy, a slightly easier, timely fashion, and you want to get married first, then you got to do it. Like, this is not hard, you know? And so when people say these worries out loud, it's my job to really pinpoint the core information, the underlying problem. And to me, that is a concern about wanting to get engaged and wanting to have that life experience and not knowing how to have that conversation with your partner outside of the context of, well, what if we want to have kids someday? Like, I have a cousin who, my husband's cousin, who, you know, didn't get into like a really serious relationship until he was a bit older and she was a bit older, and they were together for a really long time before they got engaged and married. And then they had trouble conceiving, and now they have a baby and everybody's happy, but there were a lot of problems, and part of it has to do with age. And, you know, I'm obviously not an authority on infertility, but like, it's sort of a clear thing that, like, if you start trying when you're like 32, it's going to be easier than if you start trying when you're 42. So the reader question, what if we wait too long to get married and have kids? I was like, then don't wait too long. Like, there is a problem.
So, I'm reading these right now. I mean, this is so fascinating. Like, one person wrote, what if I have an ugly baby? Like, that was a worry. You're like, no, can I control it? No. And besides, all babies are ugly. You're not going to get a real sense of how that thing turned out until much later in life. And even then, puberty does terrible things to a human. So, like, basically,
I stand by that.
I like that. But, oh, the funny, another one. What if my son doesn't have a developmental problem his doctor thinks he has, and he's just a budding sociopath?
Yeah, like, this is a really, and these were people who tweeted at me, like, with their screen names and everything. I mean, I didn't look them up. As far as I'm concerned, they're anonymous, because it's not like I really thought about who they were, but they like put these things out in public. And I was like, wow. Okay.
Wow. And all your advice is really like, it's just so simple. Either you can control it or you can't. Like, you can't control that about your kid. And like you said, you can just contribute to his overall cause by continuing to seek help versus the marriage one, like, get married and have a baby or whatever. Like, right. It's just like, I think bottom line is a lot of people worry about things that they can control. Maybe they actually don't want to get married. Like, they're not like that. Maybe there's an underlying issue going on there, but they're worried about the surface level thing. Or, like you say, worrying about things you can't control. What if you're worrying about something like your baby being ugly? And that's like a serious worry that you have. Like, what if someone can't just let it go? Like, do you have any advice for letting it go beyond just telling somebody, let it go?
I mean, I honestly, at a certain point, I don't. So there are kind of three levels of advice.
One of them
is just fucking let it go. And these particular pieces of advice come in the book in the context of after I have given a whole lot of background, you know, information about how you can stop worrying about things, whatever. But it's like, just fucking let it go. And then the next one is the sleight of mind, which is distracting yourself, changing, you know, changing your mindset, preoccupying yourself with something else. And then the third solution is that what we talked about earlier, the productive, helpful, effective worrying. Unfortunately, with the ugly baby thing, I don't think there really is anything productive, helpful, and effective that you can do to ensure, like, you can't, like, influence what your baby looks like. So in that case, I would have to revert back to just fucking let it go.
I love that. Let's talk about expectations a little bit, because I think expectations, second to worry, is at least at the top of my anxiety or sadness causes in my life. Like, I am famous in my own life, or, you know, getting depressed right after a vacation, coming home, you know, back to reality, or getting depressed on a vacation because I expected it to be a certain way, or I've had so many times. Now I don't get excited for trips. Like, we just went on our honeymoon, and everyone was, before it was like, oh my God, thanks. And everyone was like, oh my God, are you so excited? I was like, no. Same with my wedding, even more importantly. Everyone was like, oh my God, your wedding. I was like, it's just going to be a night. It's just a party. And that's my way of preserving, because I am like expectation queen over here. So what do you say about expectations in your book, and what are your thoughts on it? I mean, do you think most people are like me and expectations causes a ton of anxiety?
I'm like you.
There you go.
And I think my husband is not at all like us.
Interesting.
I've really been working very hard on, you know, lowering and managing my own expectations, both for my ability to do something, you know, to succeed at something, to accomplish something, but also my expectations for other people, because you can't control other people's actions and other people's skills and other people's spend of time. You can't control it. So you have to be able to let it go. And it's not an easy lesson to learn, but it is simple. It's a binary. Can I control it? No. Can I control the fact that, you know, my aunt is a perennially late person? No. I can't control what time she's going to show up at a restaurant, but I can control telling her that the reservation is a half hour earlier than it really is. So I just really think that, again, it's a shift in mindset. It's recognizing, which you obviously already do, about yourself, this aspect of yourself that is unlikely to change. Mm-hmm. So how do you work around it? You know, what is the work?
I mean, so simple. Everything I ask you, your answer is, if you can control it, control it. If you can't, let it go. I mean, I'm just going to keep going until you change, but I don't think you're budging anytime soon. Let's talk a little bit about overthinking. Tell me how overthinking, you know, makes all this worse. And how do we know when we're overthinking versus not just being careful or logical?
So I talk about in Calm the Fuck Down, the four faces of freaking out. And those are anxiety, sadness, anger, and avoidance. And those are the four big categories under which freaking out in some form or another exists in most people. And with anxiety, the real bear is overthinking. You know, that is the primary. You've got the sweats, you're nauseous, you can't sleep, whatever. But the big, most toxic aspect of anxiety is overthinking, sending you into this mode where your brain is just whirling along and causing you to not be able to sleep, causing you to feel ill, whatever it is. The antidote to that is focus. So, and I'm pretty clear in the book about, you know, the four faces of freaking out and their flip sides. And in terms of anxiety and overthinking, focus is the flip side. So it's about peeling away the layers of the stuff that's stressing you out. What I also talk about in the book, I call naming your tarantulas.
Yes, when I just underlined anxious, that. Okay.
When you're feeling anxious and you're overthinking, you have to be able to say, wait, what is the one thing? How do I narrow this down? What is the thing that is causing me to feel this way? Because it's easy to say, oh, I just feel like gross for no reason and I don't know why. And then it, like, it just creates this, you know, this mess inside your head. So it's really important to identify the underlying problem. And once you have done that, you can focus on that thing and that thing alone, you know, to calm the fuck down and deal with it.
And then get your shit together.
Exactly.
Pull that one out of the archives.
Get your shit together is more proactive. It's more when you have time to plan. Mm. That book is really about setting goals and having time to achieve them. Whereas calming the fuck down is kind of like get your shit together on steroids. Like something is happening and you have to be able to react, you know, swiftly and well. So these tips and techniques that I teach throughout the book are about kind of honing your reaction skills and being able to ask yourself the one question to rule them all. Being able to say, I'm anxious. Okay, I should focus. I'm sad. I need to make myself happier. I'm angry. I need to be more peaceful. You know, and those, again, they're very facile dualities. Like, I'm not saying, like, if you're clinically depressed, you have to go out and just be happy and go to the circus and get happy. But in a really general sense, if you can master these binaries, can I control it? Yes or no? You know, am I happy? What's the opposite of happy? Am I anxious? What's the opposite of anxious? And work toward your solution from there. I just think it makes things more achievable.
Yeah. Where did the tarantula thing come in?
Oh, so I tell the story in the introduction of, you know, my new wonderful island home in the DR and coming home one night to find a very large tarantula on our deck in between myself and the front door. And I freaked out. I was like, ah, come get the tarantula, you know, and it was dark and I was a little drunk and my husband ended up kind of like sweeping it into the neighbor's bushes. Oh. And then, you know, I was like, oh God, that was terrible. I got to go to bed, you know, and then I woke up really early in the morning because we were going on a boat trip and I came downstairs and the tarantula was in our house. And you have to understand that this was about, and I know it came back because it had 7 legs. And so we knew it was the same one as the night before because it was missing one of its legs. So what was weird was that like this tarantula had moved probably 100 feet from where we had seen it the night before. It had come across the deck, up onto the terrace, across the terrace, and then somehow squeezed between the glass doors. Like our house is not really hermetically sealed. So it had really come for me, you know, like it had thought about this and like gotten inside my house. And I saw it when I was coming down the landing and I was just like, well, I have a boat to get on and like that boat's not leaving without me and I need to pack all the boat stuff. So I said to my husband, I'm like, Judd, come on, like put on some pants, come downstairs, like to deal with this. And it was really this moment, which was, you know, the catalyst, of course, is this tropical life where a tarantula can be in your house. But it would have been the same if I was living in New York and, you know, a pothole exploded on my block and I couldn't get to, you know, wherever I was going. You know, whatever it is, like these things happen and you kind of realize in the moment that something that would have really freaked you out before, if you just think about it in terms of like, okay, how am I going to solve this? Because this is impeding me from doing whatever else I needed to get done today. So that was really where the tarantula anecdote came from. And now I'm constantly thinking like everything is a tarantula. And then I have to stop and go, okay, now what's wrong? What's really the problem?
Thank you for saying that. I wanted to ask you, what if you can't identify why you're anxious? Like, how do you get your tarantula if you're just feeling overwhelmed or sad or just anxious? Like, what if you can't be like, I am anxious because of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it takes time and it takes asking yourself some honest questions. And there may be times where you just are like, I just don't know. I just don't know why I feel this way. And that's okay. You know, this is not a completely black and white situation here. And, you know, all of the answers are not always clear. But for me, it's that like 80% of the time that I otherwise would have just been sitting around feeling like I was feeling bad for no reason. If I had thought it through, the vast majority of the time I would have realized why I was feeling that way. And again, you have to ask yourself honest questions and give yourself honest answers. But there are going to be times when you're just going to feel melancholy. And, you know, again, this is all part and parcel of real mental illness, you know, not just like the stress of, you know, something at work, but like really, you know, depression and anxiety and panic and all that stuff go hand in hand. And, you know, you might need some a little bit more therapy than someone like me can give, but
right.
I do think that it helps the vast majority of the time
to
really ask yourself, what is it? Why am I feeling like this? And sometimes it's something like you were like, oh, because 3 days ago this happened, and that must have gotten me started thinking about this in the back of my head, and now I'm reacting to it.
Yeah,
you know, it can often be something that is not obvious or that didn't happen like 10 minutes ago. And if you can sort of unravel that, then I feel like you can start working to fix it.
I mean, this is an obvious question, but if you're worrying about something that happened, like that, like I do this often, I go out to dinner with people, I have a glass of wine, I'm really friendly and asking funny questions and just, you know, I don't really have many barriers. And then the next day I'm like, oh God, was that too offensive? Was that joke not taken as a joke? Should I not have asked how much their mortgage payment was? Like I like did that literally this weekend. And then I start worrying about it. How do you stop worrying about something that already happened?
Talia, do you have a time machine?
No.
Then you can't go back in time and control what you said.
So you just have to let that shit go.
You have to let it go. And I would say that, you know, beyond that, if having done that sort of thing causes you worries, then you could say to yourself, maybe I need to be a little bit more reserved when I'm out to dinner with people I don't know.
Right.
Or I've decided I'm not going to talk about finances with strangers. And that's what you can control so that you don't have to feel that way again the morning after a dinner party. But generally speaking, I also just really don't give a fuck about what other people think of me. So I've already achieved that like gold star status.
You do you.
Since the first book. So I don't get too caught up in things that I said.
Got it.
Over a couple of drinks.
Okay, that's fair. One other thing that I love in your book is the tonight you meet tomorrow you coping strategy. Do you want to explain that to me right now?
Yes, this is huge.
Yeah.
And this is actually something that was really introduced to me by my husband, so I have to give him full credit.
Judd.
Basically,
is that his name?
Judd. Okay. I had such a hard time sleeping. My head was whirling and, you know, I was just always not being able to sleep. And at some point, he looked at me and he said, "Tonight Sarah's job is to go to sleep. Tomorrow Sarah can deal with that shit tomorrow." And it was like a switch was flipped because the Sarah that was anxious about whatever it was she had to get done, whether it was getting somebody's birthday gift or preparing a presentation or getting to the airport on time, was like, oh, you're right. I'm not going to be able to do any of that shit without a good night's sleep. So the achiever in me, the one who wants to cross things off the list and do things properly and you know, be like, be in charge and be in control, was like, okay. The thing I can do is sleep. And if I get that good night's sleep, I trust that tomorrow Sarah will do all of the things that she has to do. And, you know, another way to explain it to yourself is like, did you ever fail to get to the airport on time? Like, I don't fail to get to the airport on time. So why am I lying awake at night worrying about, you know, getting to the airport on time?
We actually missed a flight to the Bahamas because of snow in New York. We got caught in a snowstorm and missed the flight and hadn't planned enough time. We stupidly thought the Bahamas was like Florida. So we didn't realize it was like an international flight and we needed to get there way earlier.
Yeah.
But shit happens. I don't know. I think in the car, we were just like, whatever.
That's also a teachable moment.
Yes.
I should actually correct myself. We did miss a flight once.
There you go.
It was the first flight that we had TSA pre-check for.
Oh.
And we had gotten our TSA pre-check and we're like, sweet,
you got
we don't
cocky.
Have to show up at the airport, you know, an hour and a half early. And we got to the airport like 40 minutes early and we, you know, moseyed our way over to the kiosk and put in our credit card to get our boarding pass. And it was like, sorry, boarding closes, you know, 39 minutes and 50 seconds, 59 seconds before. And I was like, what? Because we didn't check in online earlier because we'd never checked in online before flights because we always get to the airport 2 hours in advance.
Yeah.
So we were so excited about this ability to not have to get to the airport so soon. And neither one of us really knew anything about checking in online. We just never did it. So if you hadn't checked in, you were shit out of luck. And that was, we were on our way to a wedding and we had to like, it was a very expensive error. And now we know, and we'll never do it again. But you know, in any case.
That's funny. I think everyone has that story.
I don't lie awake at night thinking about stuff like that anymore. And some people said to me, one of my editors said to me, I just don't believe it. I think that advice is really too flippant. This tonight you, tomorrow you. I just don't think people can make themselves sleep. And then one of my publicists emailed me and said, oh my God, you've given me the gift of sleep.
Oh,
tonight
wow.
you, tomorrow you. Totally works. So, you know, maybe it won't work for you, but it works for me. And it was really a revelation.
I wanted to ask you, about going back to the expectations just for a sec, because I just remembered this. How do you maintain low expectations or no expectations? I mean, you're a New York Times number one bestselling author. Like, you have a new book coming
one.
Out.
But yes,
oh, sorry, top. I don't know how it works. But you're a New York Times yeah. bestselling author. Like, you have a new book coming out. What are you doing in your mind? What kind of mental decluttering are you doing to set yourself up emotionally and mentally for this experience?
I really stay focused on reality.
And there you go, focus again.
I talk about this in the book in a few places. Reality is a very important barometer for me. Some people live their lives reaching for, aspiring, fantasizing about whatever could be. And I really prefer, for my own mental health, to think about how things are and to adjust my expectations accordingly. And so I worked in the publishing industry for 15 years, so I have a certain perspective on book publishing that I think helped me when I became an author because I saw so many books fail, great books, books that did everything right, books that had good publicity. And I was just like, okay, well, that, you know, that happens. Like, it happens a lot. So I'm not going to get too, you know, too ridiculously overexcited about my prospects. Now, things went really well for me, but book over book, I never expect anything. I always am like, okay, this is the reality of the situation, and we're going to start from there. And if I get pleasantly surprised with, you know, certain publicity hits or certain sales figures, then that's great. But I think that reality is just a really important barometer for me. And it comes into play in all of my books, but especially in Calm the Fuck Down. You know, how likely is something to happen? If it's not likely, stop worrying about it. Can I control it? Mm-hmm. If you can't, you know, move on. Like, these are very concepts rooted in reality.
The can I control it question is the most liberating. Every time you say that out loud, like, I feel more relaxed. It's just the most liberating thing to just say, can I control it? No, actually, I can't. Then, like, why are you worrying about something you can't control? It's just so silly, but we all do it. And I just love that your book. It's freaking awesome. And I'm so excited for everybody to read it and listen to this. And I think it's going to help so many people.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I got to ask you my planty questions because you are on the Party My Plants podcast. So last time I asked you your favorite plant party restaurant, if I remember correctly, you said your husband's cooking.
Yes.
That is probably still true.
Well, yes. I mean, he really is my primary cook. Like, we don't go out as much, you know, since we live in a place that only has like 10 restaurants.
Yeah. What's the cuisine's like tropical, right?
It's actually pretty varied around here because there's a lot of European expats as well. So there's some French food, some Italian food, but like it's a lot of fresh fish. You know, it's really a lot of like fish and rice and vegetables and then the occasional Italian or French night out.
That's funny.
There's a particularly delicious, extremely garlicky gazpacho that is at this restaurant called Dieciocho, and they give it, it's like the amuse-bouche, you know, so they give it to you before dinner every time. And it's kind of like crack. Like, wow. I don't know what they put in it apart from a lot of garlic, but it's really good.
There you go.
And now I want to go eat it.
Yeah. What's the restaurant called?
It's called El Dieciocho.
You said that very nicely. I'll try to find that online. Okay. What is your favorite plant to eat?
What is my favorite plant to eat? Is a potato a plant?
Yeah. Any vegetable.
Yes. Potatoes.
Nice. Just regular white ones?
Just potatoes in any format. They can be mashed. They can be scalloped. They can be fried. They can be baked.
Nice. Sweet. What is your most used kitchen tool or your husband's?
Mine is the wine opener.
Love
that. I would say that based on the dishes, which I often do, he uses his grater. Like, he's always grating garlic or ginger.
Fancy.
Or like lime peels or something, because I'm always cleaning that shit.
That's so funny that you just know based on doing the dishes and the wine opener. Amazing. What is, of your book, this is a tough one. I wrote this earlier. Your favorite anxiety-busting tool?
Oh, for sure. It's the tip called give anxiety the finger.
Oh, good. We didn't cover this one yet.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this is basically, it's part of sleight of mind. It's making you focus on something else than the thing that is giving you anxiety. And it's all about using your hands. So just turning off your brain, knitting, gardening, you know, sanding down your deck, whatever you want to do. You could be juggling, you'd be doing a Rubik's Cube. But for me, like, I spend so much of my life is intellectually. I'm writing, I'm debating, I'm arguing, I'm reading. And so it is so nice to be able to just turn off the brain and just lose myself in a hands-on task. And I have like a very jungly yard because everything grows like crazy around here. So I'm often just out there with kitchen scissors, just kind of like snipping the bushes in my yard and really like zoning out to it. So I call it give anxiety the finger because it's a hands-on activity and it really works for me.
I mean, you basically just described like self-care, but with a very funny term.
That's kind of my brand.
Right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's exactly. Just like an activity that brings you joy, that's like mindless and that's maybe with nature, just something you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on self-care?
I think self-care is what you make of it. And like, I think it's weird that there's been kind of a backlash on self-care. Started about a year ago, I remember there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that was really bitchy about self-care. And I was like, you know what? Like, we all have a hard time. Like, can we just do what we need to do to feel better? Like, why are we, like, pissing on people for wanting to, like, get massages or take bubble baths?
Wow. I missed that backlash. I feel so out of the loop.
Yeah, actually, no, it was in the Washington Post. I'm remembering now. Yeah, it was just this guy who was writing about, like, the new trend of books and blah, blah, blah. And people are making self-care. You know, it's not just about taking a bubble bath. Like, you really have to do the mental work. And I was like, dude, just, you know, yeah. You do you. I'll do me.
Give, like, him the finger.
Calm the fuck down.
Yeah. Send him a copy. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. So you're a self-care proponent, but you call it something totally different, which is your brand, and hilarious.
Oh, there you go.
You also talk about movement. I just want to note, because I always say that exercise is my Xanax. Whenever mm-hmm. I'm stressed, I go for a run, and I pretty much run every day just to, as like prevention for anxiety mm-hmm. attacks and stuff. But you talk about that and how it naturally boosts our serotonin. Mm-hmm. Nice. Just wanted to say that.
Yeah. Oh, and actually, I'm reading an advanced copy of a book right now called Burnout by Emily Nagoski and her sister Amelia Nagoski. And I should just say this because the book is coming out in March of 2019 and she would be a great guest for you. They would Ooh. Both be a great guest for you. But she it's called, you know, like Burnout, the Science of Reducing the Stress Cycle, something like that. I'm getting the subtitle potentially mangled. But she's like, exercise, exercise, exercise. Like if anybody wants just one tip, the tip is to move your body. Like that yes. is going to help you. And I'm reading it. And I'm like, I hate exercising, but you're right. So,
but you say you take walks and stuff that's good for.
I hate the idea of having to exercise, but I don't mind moving around.
Okay. That's your next book. Ooh, you should do one of your signature books on like mentally decluttering exercise.
That would be.
There you go. $1 million idea. Yeah, you can have it. What is your favorite book of your four? That's mean. That's just a mean question.
Yeah. I can tell you my favorite book of the four is You Do You. I should probably say Calm the Fuck Down because then that will help people like want to go out and buy it. But if I'm being really honest, my favorite book is You Do You. I just think it's stuff that everybody needs to hear. And I wish I had been told it when I was 14, 15, 21, 30. I think it's a really important and good book, but all of them are useful in their own way.
It is so important. My license plate for my first car was 171 URU. And every time I see your book, I think of that and just how important that message really is. Like, you know, we really do. And I always, once I got my car, like I always carried that with me, like you are you, you do you, like be you. And I think that is just an incredible, with your signature hilarity and just like tough love, like straight shoot. And that's a fabulous one, as is this one, as are they all.
Thank you.
As is they are all there. Okay. What is a book besides your own that's inspired you in an awesome way?
Okay. Well, what did I say last time?
I don't know.
Was this a question? I was going
by memory. Yeah. I just remembered last time you said that about your husband, by memory, the restaurant.
Well, I will say this. I read this year what I think is destined to be the book of the year, called Educated by Tara Westover. And while I had already, obviously, left home, gotten a really good education, moved out into the world, and exposed myself to things beyond my somewhat rural upbringing. Educated is really is that path on a grand scale. You know, she grew up as the child of fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, sort of off-grid, anti-government parents. And it's this incredible story of perseverance and self-motivation and discovering the world. And reading it just made me, it was really inspiring. I was like, wow, this woman is unreal. And it's all over the, you know, it's all over the best of lists. So if anybody hasn't heard of it or read it yet, Educated by Tara Westover.
Awesome. Excellent book. Cool. Last time you said the life-changing magic of tidying up.
Oh, well, that LOL. Was incredibly inspiring and yes, it certainly was. Changed my life.
That's what you said. And your last favorite plant to eat was mushrooms, by the way.
Mm, I do like mushrooms.
Yeah.
Maybe awesome. I thought that potatoes didn't count because they're not particularly healthy.
That's fine. Well, now we got two. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it. And I'm so excited for your book to go out. And you're awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And congratulations again on the recent wedding and honeymoon.
Thank you.
And, you know, manage those expectations, girl.
Yes. Thanks so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. I want to pair this episode with episode 147, meaning if you like this one, then pour some more hot water in your mug with a tea bag and sit back with episode 147 as well. It's a perfect chaser. 147 is actually an interview with the author of the burnout book that Sarah suggested at the end of this chat. It's a conversation all about the science of burnout and the art of preventing it. And considering I'm in the midst of brutal burnout right now, which I will fill you in on when I can properly fill you in on it without draining my cup even more dry, but my interview with burnout author Emily Nagoski is pretty personal. And considering that anxiety and burnout go together like almond butter and bananas, I highly suggest you listen or re-listen to hear what burnout is and how, if you're in the throes of it, how to heal it. Okay, so toodaloo till next time, my friend. Thank you so much for listening and have a happy and healthy and less anxiety 2020.